The terrorist leaders had no chance whatsoever. When the paratroopers broke into their flats, they reached for their weapons, but the soldiers were faster. In minutes, the three terrorists were killed. Abu Yusuf's wife tried to shield him with her body and was hit as well. Another casualty was an old Italian woman who lived across the landing from Adwan's apartment. She heard the shots, opened the door, and was slain with a burst of gunfire. During the operation, the commandos collected documents that they found in the cupboards and drawers of the Black September leaders. Then, they collected their wounded and dead and rushed to the cars headed for the beach where the rubber dinghies were waiting. On the beach, the six Mossad tourists parked their rented cars in a neat row, leaving the keys in the ignitions. A few days later, the rental companies received the payment via American Express. The task force was reunited on the mothership and sailed to Israel. The operation was a total success. The PFLP headquarters was no more. The Black September leaders had been killed, among them Abu Yusuf, the organization commander. But the commandos didn't know that barely 50 yards away from the house on Rue Verdun, Ali Hassan Salameh was sleeping peacefully in an inconspicuous apartment. He had not been disturbed. The next day, when Abu Yusuf's death was announced, he became Black September's leader. Spring of youth heralded the end of Black September. The organization would never recover. After all, its leaders had been killed. All but one. In Tel Aviv, the documents seized during Spring of Youth helped solve a mystery that had preoccupied the Mossad for the previous 2 years. That was the Passover affair. In April 1971, two young, pretty French women landed at Lod Airport and tried to go through immigration with fake French passports. The airport security had received an early warning about their arrival. The girls were taken to a side room where they were searched by policewomen and Shabak female officers. The search revealed something strange. The women's clothing, including their underwear, weighed twice what would feel like its normal weight. The policewomen found that the French women's clothes were saturated by some white powder. Apparently, the clothes had been immersed in a thick solution that contained the white powder. When the garments were shaken and rubbed, large quantities of the powder dropped off. More white powder was found in the heels of the ladies' exquisite sandals. The two girls were carrying about 12 pounds of white powder that turned out to be a powerful plastic explosive. In a box of tampons in one of the girls' suitcase, the police found scores of detonators. The girls broke down under interrogation and admitted that they were sisters, daughters of a rich Moroccan businessman. Their names were Nadia and Madeleine Bardelli. They had been contacted by a man in Paris, and being adventurous by nature, had agreed to smuggle the powder. "And who else is in this with you?" the police detectives asked. That afternoon, several police officers raided the small hotel Commodore in Tel Aviv and arrested an old French couple, Pierre and Edith Burghalter. When they disassembled the transistor radio of the couple, they found it had been stuffed with delayed action fuses for the manufacture of explosive charges. Pierre Burghalter burst into tears. The next day, the unsuspecting commander of the operation landed in Israel as well. An attractive 26-year-old French woman carrying a passport in the name of Francine Adeline Maria. Her true name was Evelyne Barge, and she was well known to the Mossad as a professional terrorist, a fanatic Marxist who already had participated in several terrorist attacks in Europe. When interrogated by police, the members of the so-called Passover team confessed that they had intended to blow up their plastic charges in 9 major Tel Aviv hotels at the peak of the tourist season and kill as many tourists and Israelis as possible, dealing Israel a heavy blow. This nice bunch went to jail, but the man who pulled the strings behind the scenes had not been caught. He was Mohamed Boudia, a charming Algerian, a director of a Paris theater and an actor himself. Again, a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a man of culture, an intellectual and an artist, whose life on stage was but a cover for his criminal activities. He was Evelyne Barges's lover, and involved in so many love affairs that the Mossad agents called him Bluebeard. Boudia was originally under the orders of George Habash and the PFLP. A year after the Passover team had been captured, he had joined Black September and was appointed head of the organization in France. He was involved in the murder of Khader Kanou, a Syrian reporter in Paris who was suspected of being a Mossad informant. Boudia was also in charge of Black September's operations in Europe and planned an attack on a transit camp for Jewish immigrants from Russia. After Hamshari's assassination, Boudia became extremely cautious, and following him became incredibly difficult. In May 1973, a hit team of the Masada group arrived in Paris and tried to find Boudia. They had the name and address of Boudia's new lover. The agents waited patiently around the corner of the building where she lived. Finally, Boudia emerged out of nowhere and snuck inside. But the next day, when most of the residents left the building for work, he was not among them. Only after a frustrating month, when the agents had compared notes, did they notice something strange. Every morning, after the torrid nights Boudia spent with his lover, a tall, big woman would be among the people coming out of the house. At times she would be a blonde, at other times brunette. At last, the agent solved the riddle. Using his actor's talents, Boudia disguised himself as a woman before leaving the building. But now, for some reason, he stopped visiting his mistress, and the Mossad lost track of him. The only lead they still had was that every morning he traveled by subway to his meetings and took a connecting train at the Étoile station under the Arc de Triomphe. That metro station was a major hub. Scores of trains passed through it. Millions of people ran through the underground passages, switching lines. How could they find Boudia, the man with a thousand faces? But there was no other choice. Mossad agents were alerted from all over Europe. Scores of Israelis received Boudia's photos and were positioned in the corridors, passages, hallways, and platforms of the giant Étoile station. One day passed, then two and three, and nothing happened. But on the fourth day, one of the agents spotted Boudia, disguised, made up, but still the man they were looking for. This time, they stuck to him like shadows till he got into his car that was parked near the metro exit. They followed the car and watched it through the night, while Boudia stayed in a house on the Rue des Fossés Saint-Bernard, probably his new lover's abode. The next morning, June 29, 1973, Boudia approached his car, inspected it thoroughly from the outside, peeked under the chassis, and apparently satisfied, unlocked it and took the driver's seat. A deafening explosion turned the car into a heap of twisted, blackened metal and killed Boudia. According to European reporters, the Ramsad, Tzvi Zamir, watched the explosion from a street corner. But the heads of Mossad had no time to celebrate their success. An urgent message reached headquarters. A special Black September messenger, the Algerian Ben Amana, had been sent to meet with Ali Hassan Salamé. Ben Amana had crossed Europe in an odd, torturous route and had reached Lillehammer, a resort town in Norway. A few days later, the Kidone hit team, under Mike Harari's command, was positioned in Lillehammer. Nobody had any idea what Salamé was doing in the quiet mountain town. The first crew followed Ben Amana to the town's swimming pool and saw him establishing contact with a Middle Eastern-looking man. Three members of the crew looked at the photographs they carried and concluded that the man undoubtedly was Salamé. They overruled their fourth colleague, who had overheard the man speaking with other people, and pointed out that it was impossible that Salomé could speak Norwegian. The agents were cocksure in the identification. They followed Salomé in Lillehammer's streets and saw him in the company of a young, pregnant Norwegian woman. The operation entered its final stage. More agents arrived from Israel. Tzvi Zamir was among them. Salomé's elimination was to be the last step in the total destruction of Black September, and Tzvi Zamir wanted to be there for the finale. The killers were to be the ubiquitous Jonathan Ingelby, along with Ralph Baer and Gérard-Émile Lafont. David Molad did not participate in that operation. The support crew rented cars and hotel rooms. Some maintain that the town residents immediately noticed the unusual activity, the presence in Lillehammer of many tourists, whose cars whooshed in all directions, was not a common sight in Lillehammer during the summer. On July 21, 1973, Salomé and his pregnant friend came out of a cinema where they had seen Clint Eastwood in Where Eagles Dare. The couple took the bus and got off on a quiet, deserted street. Suddenly, a white car braked beside them. A couple of men jumped out on the sidewalk, Beretta guns in their hands, and sprayed Salomé's body with 14 bullets. The Red Prince was dead. The operation over, Mike Harari ordered his men to leave Norway right away. The pullout was done according to the rules. The killers left first, abandoning their white car in Lillehammer's center, and took the first flights out of Oslo, the capital. Most of the agents and Mike Harari were the next to depart, leaving behind the crew that was to evacuate the safe houses and return the rental cars. But an unexpected coincidence turned everything upside down. A woman who lived near where the shooting took place noticed the color, white, and the make, Peugeot, of the killer's car. A police officer, manning a roadblock between Lillehammer and Oslo, saw a white Peugeot driven by a striking-looking woman and noted the car's license plate. The following day, when the car was returned at the airport car rental desk, the police arrested its occupants, Dan Erbel and Marian Gladnikov. Their interrogation brought about the arrest of two more agents, Sylvia Raphael and Avraham Gamer. Another two agents were arrested the same day. Erbel and Gladnikov broke down under the intensive interrogation. They revealed top-secret information about the operation, addresses of safe houses in Norway and throughout Europe, conspiracy rules, phone numbers, and modus operandi of the Mossad. The police raided an apartment in Oslo and found a trove of documents there. They also discovered that Yigal Eyal, the Israeli embassy security officer, had a connection with the Mossad. It was a disaster. The next day, Norway's media published the news about the Israeli agents' arrests. It was a terrible blow to the Mossad's prestige and credibility. But the media published another piece of news, even more devastating. The Mossad had killed the wrong man. The man killed in Lillehammer was not Ali Hassan Salomé. He was Ahmed Bouchiki, a Moroccan waiter who had come to Norway looking for a job. He had also married a Norwegian woman, the blonde Toril, who was 7 months pregnant. Sensational headlines sprouted all over the world's newspapers. The captured agents stood trial, and some of them were sentenced to long prison terms. One of them, Sylvia Raphael, made a strong impression on the Norwegians by her proud and noble appearance. Her trial brought her an unexpected prize. She fell in love with her Norwegian attorney, and after her release from jail, she married him and lived happily with him till she died of cancer in 2005. After the Lillehammer fiasco, the heads of the Mossad had to clean house, change conspiracy rules, abandon safe houses, establish new contacts. They had to admit their responsibility for Ahmed Bouchiki's death and pay $400,000 to his family. But the worst was that the legend of the glorious, invincible Mossad had been shattered. Golda Meir ordered Zvi Zamir to end Wrath of God immediately, but soon the failure was obscured by more dramatic events. On October 6th, the armies of Egypt and Syria launched a surprise attack on Israel. The Yom Kippur War had begun. See chapter 14. 2 years passed. On a balmy spring evening in 1975, a Beirut family hosted the most beautiful woman in the world. Georgina Rizik certainly deserved that title, as 4 years before she had been elected Miss Universe in the flashy beauty contest at Miami Beach, Florida. The gorgeous Lebanese beauty had won fame, awards, trips, meetings with world leaders. Back in Lebanon, she had developed a brilliant career as a supermodel and owner of fashion boutiques. That evening, in her friend's home, she met a handsome, charismatic young man. They fell in love. 2 years later, on June 8, 1977, they got married. The happy groom was Ali Hassan Salameh. His career, too, had soared in the previous few years. At the end of 1973, Black September ceased to exist. Despite the collapse of his organization, Salameh had become Arafat's right hand and his adopted son. Rumor had it that he would be appointed Arafat's successor at the helm of the PLO. After the fall of Black September, Salameh was made head of Force 17, which was in charge of personal security of the Fatah leaders and of all unorthodox coups de main. Salameh accompanied Arafat on a trip to New York. Arafat entered the United Nations General Assembly holding an olive branch in his hand, but carrying his gun on his belt. Salameh was at Arafat's side when the latter traveled to Moscow and met with powerful world leaders. To Israel's amazement, he was also courted by the CIA. In another of its great oversights, the Central Intelligence Agency decided to ignore the bloody past of the Red Prince, his role in the Munich massacre, the savage assassination of American diplomats in Khartoum that he masterminded, the simple fact that Salameh was one of the most dangerous terrorists in the world, and recruited Salameh as its informant. The CIA hoped that Salameh would become a loyal servant of American interests. The CIA offered Salameh hundreds of thousands of dollars, but he refused. On the other hand, he agreed to spend a long vacation with Georgina in Hawaii, all expenses covered by the agency. Salameh's lifestyle had changed, and his friends had started to believe that his life was no longer in danger. But he felt that his days were numbered. He did not stop speaking about his death. "I know," he said to a reporter, "that when my fate is sealed, the end will come. Nobody will be able to save me." Israel decided to seal his fate. Many changes had taken place in Israel since the downfall of Black September. Golda Meir had gone, her successor Yitzhak Rabin had resigned, and a new prime minister, Menachem Begin, was now in power. Zvi Zamir had been replaced as Ramsad by General Yitzhak Haka Hofi, a former commander of the northern region. The Palestinian terror against Israel continued in sporadic outbursts. In 1976, the hijacking of an Air France plane to Entebbe in Uganda had resulted in a daring rescue raid by Israeli paratroopers and Sayeret Matkal. In 1978, Fatah terrorists landed in Israel, hijacked a civilian bus, and proceeded to Tel Aviv. They were stopped by a roadblock in the city outskirts and were finally overpowered, but not before murdering 35 civilian passengers. Civilian men, women, and children were regularly brutally murdered in terrorist incursions into Israeli territory. Menachem Begin felt that no terrorist with blood on his hands could be left in peace. In the late 70s, Salomé's name was on the Avengers list once again. An undercover Mossad agent was sent to Beirut and managed to join the health club where Salomé exercised. One day, as he walked into the sauna, he found himself face to face with the naked Salomé. This stunning discovery triggered a fiery debate at Mossad headquarters. A naked Salomé in his health club was an easy prey. On the other hand, any attempt to kill him there could result in the death of civilians. Therefore, the plan was abandoned. Enter Erica Mary Chambers. She was a single Englishwoman, eccentric and strange, who had lived in Germany for the last 4 years. She arrived in Beirut and rented an apartment on the 8th floor of a building at the corner of Rue Verdun and Rue Madame Curie. Her neighbors nicknamed her Penelope. She told them she did volunteer work for an international organization taking care of poor children. She was seen, indeed, in hospitals and relief agencies. Some even said she had met with Ali Hassan Salomé. She seemed to be a very lonely woman. Always disheveled, shabbily dressed, Penelope would emerge on the street with plates full of food for stray cats. Her apartment was also said to be full of her beloved felines. She was also a passionate painter, but those who saw her canvases quickly realized that her talents were rather limited. But besides painting Lebanon's landscapes, what really interested Miss Chambers was the busy traffic in the street below, and more specifically, the daily passage of 2 cars under her windows, a tan Chevrolet station wagon always followed by a Land Rover Jeep. Using a code, Erica scrupulously noted the times and directions of the vehicle's movements. Every morning they came from the Snoubra neighborhood down Verdun and Curie streets, heading south toward the Fatah headquarters. They came back at lunchtime and reappeared in the early afternoon, heading to headquarters again. Watching the cars with a pair of binoculars, Erica identified Salomé sitting in the back seat of the Chevrolet between 2 armed bodyguards. Several other armed terrorists rode in the Land Rover that followed. Salomé's guards perhaps could protect him, but they could not save him from the worst enemy of a secret agent, routine. Since his marriage to beautiful Georgina, Salomé's life had fallen into a steady pattern. He had settled with his wife in the Snoubra neighborhood and would go to work like a clerk every morning at the same time, come home for lunch and rest, return to work after the siesta. He was ignoring the basic rules of secret activity: never develop regular habits, never stay at the same address for too long, never use the same itinerary twice, never travel at the same time of day. On January 18, 1979, a British tourist, Peter Scriver, arrived in Beirut, checked into the Mediterranee Hotel, and rented a blue Volkswagen Golf at the Lenacar Agency. The same day, he met with a Canadian tourist, Ronald Kohlberg, who stayed at the Royal Garden Hotel and rented a Simca Chrysler, also at Lenacar. Kohlberg was none other than David Molad. The third client of the popular rental agency walked into its office the following day. That was Erica Chambers, who asked to rent a car for a trip in the mountains. She signed out a Datsun, which she parked close to her home. That night, 3 Israeli missile boats approached a deserted beach between Beirut and the port of Junya and left a large load of explosives on the wet sand. Kohlberg and Scriver were there. They loaded the explosives in the Volkswagen. On January 21st, Peter Scriver checked out of his hotel, drove the blue Volkswagen to Rue Verdun, and parked it in full view of Erica Chambers's windows. He then took a cab to the airport and boarded a flight to Cyprus. Ronald Kohlberg checked out of his hotel too and moved to the Montmartre Hotel in Junya. At 3:45 p.m., as usual, Ali Hassan Salomé entered his Chevrolet. His bodyguards took the Land Rover and the small motorcade headed for the Fatah headquarters. the cars moved down Rue Madame Curie and turned into Rue Verdun. From the eighth floor of the corner building, Erica Chambers watched them approach. Molad stood beside her, holding a remote control device. The Chevrolet sailed smoothly past the blue Volkswagen. At that moment, Molad pressed the switch on the remote control. The Volkswagen exploded, turning into a huge ball of fire. The Chevrolet, engulfed by the flames, blew up in turn. Chunks of metal and splinters of glass were projected violently upward. Windows in the neighboring houses were shattered, and pieces of glass rained down on the sidewalk. Horrified passers-by stared at the bodies of the Chevrolet's passengers, strewn about the smoldering debris. Police cars and ambulances rushed toward the scene, and the medics pulled out of the Chevrolet's twisted chassis the bodies of the driver, the two bodyguards, and Ali Hassan Salameh. In Damascus, a harried messenger brought an urgent telegram to Yasser Arafat, who was presiding over a meeting at the Meridian Hotel. Stunned, Arafat perused the telegram and burst into tears.
That same night, a rubber dinghy, launched from an Israeli missile boat, landed at Junia Beach.
Ronald Kohlberg and Erica Chambers jumped onto the dinghy that took them to its mother ship. A few hours later, they were in Israel. The Lebanese police found their rented cars parked on the beach, keys in the ignition. Erica Mary Chambers was the real name of a Mossad agent, a British Jewess, who had lived in England and Australia before immigrating to Israel, and was recruited by the Mossad during her studies at Hebrew University. She returned to Israel and was never heard of again. That was the end of the quest and the end of Operation Wrath of God. Black September was eliminated. Many years later, some of the operation's details came to light. General Aharon Yariv admitted in a television interview that he had advised Prime Minister Golda Meir to kill as many of the Black September leaders as possible. He admitted that he was surprised by the fact that a military operation by our forces in Beirut and a few killings in Europe were enough to make the Fatah leaders stop the terrorism abroad. That proves that we were right by using this method for a certain time. But that dark affair had a surprising and promising epilogue. In 1996, the Israeli journalist Daniel Ben-Simon was invited by friends to a merry party in Jerusalem. He met a young, pleasant Palestinian there, impeccably dressed and speaking fluent English. He introduced himself as Ali Hassan Salameh. That's the name of the man who masterminded the massacre of the Israeli athletes in Munich, Ben-Simon said. He was my father, the young man said. He was murdered by the Mossad. He told the amazed Ben-Simon that he had lived for years with his mother in Europe and finally had come to Jerusalem as Yasser Arafat's guest. I would never have believed, he added, that the day would come when I'd be dancing together with young Israelis at a party in Jerusalem. He described his voyage throughout Israel, the warm hospitality of the Israelis he had met, and expressed his desire to help conciliate Israelis and Palestinians. I am a man of peace, 100%, young Salameh said. My father lived in times of war and paid for that with his life. Now a new era has begun. I hope that peace between Israelis and Palestinians will be the most important event in the life of those two peoples. Chapter 13. The Syrian Virgins. On a stormy night in November 1971, an Israeli Navy missile boat was struggling against the raging Mediterranean waves as it plowed its way toward the Syrian coast. It had left the big naval base in Haifa in the early evening, sailed along the Lebanese coast, and entered the Syrian territorial waters. The darkened boat passed by the illuminated Latakia port and kept its northbound course. It finally moored at a safe distance from a deserted beach close to the Turkish border. Naval commandos of Flotilla 13 emerged on board of the wildly swaying boat and launched a few rubber dinghies into the water. When they were ready to depart, the door of a locked side cabin opened, and three men in civilian clothes came out. Their faces were concealed by checkered keffiyehs, and in their watertight bags they carried small transceivers, forged passports, personal belongings, and loaded revolvers. Without uttering a word, they jumped into the dinghies and headed toward the beach. The commandos were not told their identities or the reason they were bringing these men to Syria. As they approached the coast, shortly before daybreak, the three civilians dove into the icy waters and swam toward the beach. They crouched in the surf till they saw the silhouette of a man waiting in the sand. They swam the last few yards and joined him. This was Yonatan, codenamed Prosper, their leader. He had brought dry clothes for his shivering friends, and they changed right away. He took them to his concealed car close by. A stranger, apparently Mossad's local auxiliary, was waiting at the wheel. He started the car and deftly merged into the traffic on one of Syria's main highways. A few hours later, they entered Damascus. They checked into two hotels. After a long sleep, they got together and set out to reconnoiter the Syrian capital. They all were former Flotilla 13 commandos, now Mossad agents, and were on the most unusual mission of their lives. Among them was David Molad. The operation had been planned a few weeks earlier at Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv. The Ramsad, Tzvi's Amir, the head of Caesarea, Mike Harari, and a few other department heads met with the four young men, who were between 23 and 27 years old. The four of them were close friends, had participated in several operations together, mixing their naval commando skills with their Mossad training. All of them were born in North Africa and spoke excellent French and Arabic. They called themselves the Cosa Nostra, like the Sicilian Mafia. Zamir began to brief them. 2 years ago, a message had come from Syria. It had been sent by the leaders of the dwindling Jewish community. The autocratic regime of President Hafez al-Assad, who had seized power in 1970, oppressed and persecuted the local Jews. Many of them had trickled out of the country, leaving behind a tiny, aging community. The young and able men had escaped from Syria, leaving behind Jewish girls who had no hope of finding husbands. Their best option was to escape to Israel. Some of the girls, Zamir told the Cosa Nostra, had tried to escape via Lebanon with the help of smugglers they had bribed. Some of them had been captured, beaten, tortured, even shot. A few had still managed to get to Beirut. All of them had the address of a safe house in the Lebanese capital. Local Mossad helpers had taken care of them until they could be brought to Israel. One night, in the winter of 1970, an Israeli missile boat approached the port of Junya, north of Beirut, and local fishermen brought over the 12 Jewish girls who had fled Syria. The captain of the Israeli boat was a veteran seawolf and a submariner, Colonel Avraham Zabu Ben Ze'ev. Before the operation, he and his men had undergone very rigorous training on a model they had built at a Navy base. The training had been excellent, and the transfer of the girls on board had been smooth and efficient. Zabu had his men throw blankets on the badly frightened, shivering girls, served them sandwiches and coffee, and then sailed full throttle to Haifa. He docked at 4 a.m., and to his great surprise, saw the unmistakable figure of Prime Minister Golda Meir waiting on the wharf, along with the chief of the IDF staff, General Haim Bar-Lev, and his deputy, General David Dado Elazar. Golda threw a modest party for the Syrian girls and was deeply shaken by their stories. During the following year, Ben Ze'ev and his successor on the job, Amnon Gonen, carried out a few more operations, bringing a few more young Syrian girls from the Lebanese coast to Israel. But crossing the Syrian-Lebanese border had become a very risky business, and the Arab smugglers and fishermen could not be trusted. Golda decided then that she must bring the remaining girls directly from Syria to Israel. She called Zamir and instructed him to rescue the Syrian girls. At the meeting with the Cosa Nostra, Zamir addressed the four young men. "You have to rescue those girls. That's your assignment." A heated debate broke out in the conference room. "Is this a job for Mossad agents?" one of the men asked. "This task should be given to the Jewish agency." Another angrily added that the Mossad was not a matchmaking agency, and its officers should not have to risk their lives in one of the most dangerous and cruel Arab countries just to ensure that a few Jewish virgins would find grooms. The Ramsad did not budge. He reminded his men that rescuing the Jewish communities in enemy countries was one of the Mossad's missions from its very inception. The operation was codenamed Smicha, Hebrew for blanket. The day after the Cosa Nostra landed on Syrian territory, their self-confidence improved. They walked the streets of Damascus, chatting in French. They checked their surroundings and made sure they were not followed by the Mukhabarat, the dreaded Syrian intelligence service. Later that day, they strolled in the illuminated markets of the city and entered a jewelry store. Prosper and Claudie, Emmanuel Alon, were examining the jewelry, conversing in French, when the merchant bent toward them and whispered, "You are from B'nai Amenu, Hebrew for our people, aren't you?" The agents were stunned. If they were so easy to identify, they were in mortal danger. They ignored the merchant's remark and quickly slipped out of the store and disappeared in the crowd. The news about the chance to escape Syria and reach Israel had spread among the young girls of the Jewish community. "Our situation in Syria was very bad," Sarah Gafni, one of the young women, said later. "We were under pressure to marry, but whom? There was nobody. We heard a lot of stories and rumors, and we became obsessed with the idea to get to Israel, to the land of the Jews." A message was secretly delivered to Prosper. "Tomorrow evening, the girls will be waiting in a small truck not far from your hotels." The following evening, indeed, the Cosa Nostra found the small truck, its back covered with a canvas roof, parked in a dark street. The agents had previously checked out of their hotels and carried their bags with them. Two of the Cosa Nostra sat in the front of the car, and two others got in the back. Under the canvas roof were several girls, between the ages of 15 and 20, and a teenage boy. The Cosa Nostra were wearing keffiyehs again, covering their heads and leaving just a narrow slit for their eyes. They knew that on the Syrian highways, the army and police often established barriers and checkpoints. They decided that if they were stopped by the police, they would say that the truck was taking the girls to a high school field trip. The local auxiliary, who had brought over the truck, was driving. He picked up a couple of girls in prearranged locations and then headed north, toward Tartus. They reached a deserted beach. The young Syrian Jews and the agents hid in an abandoned hut. Far from the beach, an IDF missile boat was waiting. Prosper signaled the boat with his flashlight and called them on his radio. The rubber dinghies, manned with Flotilla 13 commandos, started making their way toward the beach. All of a sudden, bursts of gunfire echoed very close to Prosper and his friends. They scrambled for cover, but soon found out that the shots were not aimed at them. Who was firing? Had the Syrians detected the flotilla dinghies? "Mess on the beach," the naval commando's chief, Gadi Kroll, radioed to Israel. But he did not give up. He called back the flotilla dinghies and sailed north to an alternative beach that had been selected beforehand. Simultaneously, Prosper and his men rushed the girls back to the truck, drove north, and again made contact with the Navy boat. This time, the beach was quiet. The girls and the Cosa Nostra men, their keffiyehs again masking their faces, waded in the water up to their waists and jumped into the dinghies that took them to the open sea. After a long and bumpy sail in the stormy waters, they finally boarded the Navy boat that turned back to Israel. The agents disappeared in a cabin. The girls were taken to another and ordered never to say a word to anybody about their escape from Syria. They had left their families in Damascus, and if their flight to Israel became known, their parents could pay for it with their lives. The local auxiliary drove the truck back to Damascus to prepare for the next operation. The missile boat arrived to Haifa without any further incident. But before sending out the boys on their next mission, the Mossad tried to find out who had fired that night on the beach. The intelligence department checked spies' reports, activated its sleepers in Syria, contacted its sources in the army, but to no avail. They concluded that the incident might have been a badly planned ambush or a nervous response by Syrian soldiers to suspicious movements in the water. The next time, the Cosa Nostra arrived in Damascus by air. They came from Paris, using the cover of archaeology students coming to visit Syria's antiquities. They carried false papers, and their pockets were full of metro, the Parisian subway tickets, coins, receipts from cafes and restaurants, and other tangible proof of their assumed identities. Their documents were in order, yet they were nervous and edgy. Perhaps the Mukhabarat had blown their cover? They went through immigration without any problems, and yet they could not calm down. They crossed the crowded arrival hall of the airport and left for the city in several taxis. The Cosa Nostra settled in different hotels. Claudie checked into the Damascus Hilton. This time, the first night they spent in Damascus was tense. The four young men knew well that if they were caught, their fate was sealed. Torture and horrible death. They asked the auxiliary to take them to the square where a few years ago the Syrians had hanged Israel's greatest spy, Eli Cohen. Standing at the very place where the body of Cohen had hung from the gallows, while a fanatic crowd cheered and waved its fists, was too much for them. Claudie left his friends and ran back to his hotel. He was deeply shaken by the experience. Haunted by the sinister image of the square, he tossed and turned on his bed, but could not sleep. Suddenly, at midnight, he heard a noise coming from the door and immediately knew what it was, a key being inserted in the keyhole. "That's it," he thought. "They've got me. I'll be the next to hang in the city square." He rushed to the door and looked through the peephole. What he saw was an elderly American tourist trying in vain to open the door. After several failed attempts, she walked away. It turned out that the lady had got off the elevator on the wrong floor. Claudie felt reborn. While they waited for the next group of girls to be prepared, they walked Damascus's streets and visited cafes and restaurants. The waiters gaped in amazement at the quartet of Fransawis, Frenchmen, who split their sides laughing during the meals. It was all Claudie's fault. He repeatedly succeeded in dispelling his buddy's tremendous tension and his own by improvising bombastic speeches in French, inserting words and jokes in Hebrew slang. This and future operations were flawlessly executed, until the day when Prosper and his friends noticed unusual traffic and large concentrations of troops along the beach. They could not risk an operation on the heavily patrolled coast. Prosper decided to change the itinerary. "Go to Beirut," he told his helper, and they raced to Lebanon's capital, 100 kilometers away. After crossing the border into Lebanon, Prosper headed for Junia, a port north of Beirut, inhabited mainly by Christians. In no time, he rented a boat, a mid-size yacht, after explaining to its owner that he wanted to take about 15 guests on a pleasure cruise, a surprise party for one of his friend's birthday. Once the boat was secured and ready for departure, he cabled in code his superiors in Paris and informed them of the change in plans. Shortly after, he received confirmation by the same channel. That night, the truck came from Damascus, carrying its usual load of young Jewish women. Claudie was at the wheel. The truck stopped a few kilometers from the Lebanese border and unloaded its human cargo. Claudie continued, alone in the truck, presented his papers at the border checkpoint, and crossed into Lebanon. There, he stopped the truck on the roadside and waited. The young women, carrying their heavy suitcases, escorted by the Mossad agents, walked in the darkness for hours, stumbling on the rock-strewn ground and bypassing the border control barrier. After an exhausting march, they reached the road on the other side of the border and met with Claudie, who drove them to Junia. They boarded the yacht one by one, and finally the yacht sailed on its birthday voyage. In the open sea, the girls were transferred to a navy boat. The Cosa Nostra spent the following day in Beirut, strolling and shopping. At night, they headed back to Damascus by the same way they had come. A few kilometers before the border, three of the agents got off and made their way in the dark fields around the checkpoint. Claudie crossed legally with his vehicle, met his friends down the road, and took them back to Damascus. The day after, they were on their way back to Paris and to Tel Aviv. The operation ended in April 1973, when Golda Meir came to Haifa Naval Base to personally thank Prosper, Claudie, and their friends for what they had done. Between September 1970 and April 1973, the Mossad and the Navy had carried out about 20 operations for bringing young Jews and Jewesses from Syria via the Tartus beaches and the Lebanese coast. All the operations were successful, and about 120 young people were brought to Israel. The operation was kept secret for more than 30 years. That was the end of the Cosa Nostra. Its members turned to more peaceful activities, like business, tourism, and civil service, even though they were still called back for special Mossad operations once in a while. Time passed, and Emmanuel Alon, Claudie, was invited to the wedding of a relative. He was introduced to the bride and recognized her immediately. She was one of the virgins he had helped bring over from Syria. He asked her, "Where do you come from?" The girl paled. She felt she was still bound by the secret of her past. Alon smiled at her. "Didn't you come from Syria? By sea?" The stunned woman almost fainted, and then all of a sudden grabbed his arms, hugged and kissed him warmly. "It was you," she mumbled. "You took me out of there." "This moment," Alon said later, "was worth all the risks we took." Chapter 14. Today We'll Be at War. On October 5th, 1973, at 1 a.m., Mossad agent codenamed Dubi got a phone call from Cairo. Dubi, a senior case officer, operated from a safe house in London. The phone call was a tremendous shock. On the line was the most important and most secret agent of the Mossad, whose very existence was known only to a select few. He was known as the Angel. In some reports, he was codenamed Rashash or Hat-El. The Angel uttered a few words, but one of them made Dubi shudder. It was chemicals. Dubi immediately called the Mossad headquarters in Israel and conveyed the code word. As soon as it reached the Ramsad, Tzvi Zamir, he told his chief of staff, Freddy Aini, "I am going to London." He knew he had no time to lose. The code word chemicals carried an ominous message. Expect an immediate attack on Israel. Israel was expecting an attack by its Arab neighbors since the 1967 Six-Day War, in which it gained large chunks of territory, the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip from Egypt, the Golan Heights from Syria, the West Bank and Jerusalem from Jordan. The IDF was now deployed on the Golan Heights, on the eastern shore of the Suez Canal, and along the Jordan River. The Arab countries were rattling their sabers, promising revenge. But in the war of attrition that had followed the Six-Day battles, Israel had the upper hand. All its efforts to trade the newly conquered territories for peace had been angrily rejected by the Arab states. In the meantime, Egypt's fiery President Nasser had died and been replaced by Anwar Sadat, a man lacking charisma, regarded by the Israeli experts as weak, irresolute, and unable to lead his people to a new war. After the death of Prime Minister Eshkol, Israel's leadership had been entrusted to the strong hands of charismatic Golda Meir, a tough and powerful stateswoman, assisted by the world-famous Minister of Defense, Moshe Dayan. Israel's security, it seemed, couldn't be in better hands. A few weeks before the phone call, in utmost secrecy, King Hussein of Jordan had flown to Israel and warned Golda that the Egyptians and Syrians were planning an attack on Israel. Hussein had become Israel's secret ally and was engaged in intensive negotiations with Golda's envoys. But at the time, Golda was not focused on Hussein's warnings. She was much more interested in the forthcoming elections, and Golda's Labour Party campaigned under the slogan, "All is quiet on the Suez Canal." Barely 18 hours before Yom Kippur, it appeared that nothing was quiet on the Suez Canal. Tzvi Zamir took the angel's warning very seriously. According to the prearranged procedures, triggered by the code word, the Ramsad was to meet his agent in London as soon as he got the signal. Zamir boarded the first flight to London. On the sixth floor of an apartment building in the British capital, not far from the Dorchester Hotel, the Mossad kept a discreet safe house. The apartment was bugged, serviced, and secured by Mossad agents. It had been acquired and equipped for only one purpose: meetings with the angel. As soon as Tzvi Zamir arrived, a detachment of 10 Mossad agents took positions around the building to protect their chief in case the signal from Cairo was part of a plot to capture or injure him. The head of the unit was veteran Tzvi Malkin, the legendary agent that had helped catch Eichmann in Argentina. Zamir, tense and agitated, waited for the angel all day long. His agent apparently had made a stopover in Rome, on its way from Cairo, and reached London only in the late evening. The two men met at the safe house at 11 p.m. In the meantime, Yom Kippur, the holiday of prayer, fasting, and atonement, had settled upon Israel. All work had ceased, the television and radio had stopped their broadcasts, no cars moved on the roads. Skeleton army units manned the borders of the Jewish state. The meeting between Zamir and the angel lasted 2 hours. Duby noted every word. It was close to 1 a.m. when the meeting ended. Duby invited the angel into another room where he paid him his customary fee of $100,000. Zamir, frantic, hurriedly composed an urgent telegram to Israel, but the Mossad agents couldn't find the embassy encoder to transmit the vital message. Finally, Zamir lost his cool and placed a call to Freddie Aney's home. The calls were not answered, and the harried operator told him, "There is no answer, sir. I think today is an important holiday in Israel." "Try again," Zamir growled. Finally, the ringing woke up his chief of staff, and he picked up the phone. He sounded half asleep. "Take a basin of cold water," Zamir said to him. Put your feet in it and pick up pen and paper.
When Freddy did as he was told, Zamir dictated the code phrase. The company will sign the contract by the end of the day. Then Zamir added, Now get dressed, go to headquarters and wake everybody up.
Freddy followed Zamir's orders to the letter. He started calling the political and military leaders of Israel. His message to them could be summed up in one sentence. War will break out today.
Shortly afterward, the telegram that Zamir had written finally arrived in Tel Aviv. According to the plan, the Egyptians and the Syrians are going to attack in the early evening. They know that today is a holiday, and they believe that they can land on our side of the Suez Canal before dark. The attack would be carried out according to the plan which is known to us. He, the angel, believes that Sadat cannot delay the attack because of his promise to other Arab heads of state, and he wants to keep his commitment to the last detail. The source estimates that in spite of Sadat's hesitation, the chances that the attack will be carried out are 99.9%. They believe they'll win. That's why they fear an early disclosure that may cause an outside intervention. This may deter some of the partners who then will reconsider. The Russians will not take part in the operation. The Ramsad's dramatic report was not accepted by everybody at face value.
General Eli Zeira, the handsome, confident chief of Amman, was convinced that there was no danger of war, in spite of the worrying reports by intelligence sources.
He believed that the huge concentrations of Egyptian soldiers and armor on the African shore of the Suez Canal were nothing but a part of a large army maneuver.
Zeira also admitted, in a conversation with Zamir,
that he had no explanation as to why a report by Unit 848, later renamed Unit 8200, 848 was the listening and monitoring installation of the IDF, stated that the families of the Russian military advisors in Syria and Egypt were urgently leaving those countries, a surefire indication of imminent war. The chief of Amman and most of the defense community leaders were firm believers in conception, a theory that Egypt would attack Israel only under two conditions. First, that it would receive from the Soviet Union fighter jets able to face the Israeli fighter aircraft, as well as bombers and missiles that would reach Israel's population centers. And second, that it would assure the participation of the other Arab countries in the onslaught. As long as these two conditions had not been met, the conception said, there was no chance that Egypt would attack. Egypt would make threats, would tease and provoke, would carry out mammoth maneuvers, but wouldn't go to war. But the theory had already failed before, in 1967. That year, a large part of the Egyptian army was in Yemen, where it waged a prolonged war against the Royal Army. Israel was convinced that Egypt wouldn't initiate any provocative or aggressive action as long as part of its army was tied up in the Yemenite quagmire. But on May 15, 1967, the elite units of the Egyptian army suddenly crossed the Sinai and reached the Israeli border, while President Nasser expelled the United Nations observers and closed the Straits of the Red Sea to Israeli shipping. Israeli experts should have realized the failure of their logic, but in the afterglow of the astonishing victory of the Six-Day War, it was forgotten. The conception theory hovered over the extraordinary cabinet meeting called in the early hours of October 6, 1973.
Not only Zeira, but several cabinet ministers as well, doubted the report about an imminent Egyptian-Syrian surprise attack.
Twice in the past, in November 1972 and May 1973, the angel had flashed Israel a warning about a forthcoming attack. True, he had retracted at the last moment, but in May 1973, huge numbers of reserve soldiers had been urgently mobilized,
and the operation had cost Israel the staggering sum of $34.5 million. At this morning's cabinet meeting, everybody was conscious of the gravity of the situation. Nevertheless, they only decided on a partial mobilization of reservists. The ministers also decided not to launch a preventive strike on the huge Egyptian concentrations of troops along the canal. Zamir returned to Israel and stuck to his guns. War is imminent. He quoted the angel's warning of a joint offensive by the Egyptian and Syrian armies shortly before sunset.
At 2 p.m., Zaira summoned the military correspondents to his office and stated that there was only a low probability of war breaking out. He was still speaking when an aide walked into his office and handed him a short note. Zaira read it and, without another word, grabbed his beret and hurried out of the room.
A few moments later, the wail of the air raid sirens shattered the silence of Yom Kippur. The war had begun. After the war, senior Amman officers angrily accused the angel of having misled Zamir by mentioning the end of the day as the H hour for the attack, while the real offensive had started at midday. Only later it was established that the H hour had been modified at the last moment in a phone conversation between the presidents of Syria and Egypt. The angel was already in the air, on his way to London. It seems strange that the Amman chiefs were disturbed by the angel's mistake or by his former mistaken warnings. Apparently, Amman's chiefs regarded the angel not as an intelligence source, but as the Mossad's representative in the office of Egypt's president, who was supposed to report in full detail everything that happened there. They ignored the fact that, in spite of his senior position, the angel was only a spy. He produced excellent reports, but did not always know everything, as is the case with any other spy. During the Yom Kippur War that broke out that day, the angel kept supplying Israel with first-rate intelligence. When the Egyptians fired two Scud missiles at IDF troop concentrations, a reassuring report by the angel calmed the Israelis. The Egyptian army had no intention of using more missiles during the fighting, he said, and Egypt wouldn't escalate the war against Israel. The Yom Kippur War ended on October 23rd. In the Golan Heights, the Syrian army had been routed, and the Israeli cannons were positioned 20 miles from Damascus. In the south, the Egyptians had occupied a strip 5 miles wide on the Israeli shore of the Suez Canal, but their Third Army was completely surrounded by the Israelis, who had established a bridgehead in Egyptian territory, broken the Egyptian lines, and attained new positions barely 63 miles from Cairo. Still, Israel could not rejoice with this victory. The war had cost them 2,656 lives, wounded 7,251, and the myth of its superior power had been destroyed. Yet negotiations had started between Israelis and Egyptians, and accords were signed, first for the ending of hostilities, then for establishing durable peace between the two nations. Syria refused to join the peace process. Tzvi Zamir completed his tour of duty and was replaced by General Yitzhak Hakka Hofi. Zamir retired amid general praise for his achievements. He was acclaimed for being the only one in the intelligence community to have warned about the military preparations of the Syrians and the Egyptians, and for bringing the crucial report about the imminent attack on Israel. If Israel's leaders had been more attentive to his warnings and ordered an immediate preventive strike, it is highly probable that the results would have been far better for Israel. Certain cabinet ministers maintained that Israel refrained from preventive action so that it could not be accused of starting the war. Not only does this seem contrived, it seems a nearsighted decision. For what was more important, that Israel not be accused of triggering the war, or that it protect itself with all the means at its disposal. And yet, the Israeli historian Dr. Uri Bar Yosef maintains that the angel's warning saved the Golan Heights. On the morning of October 6th, he wrote, "Tank crews had been urgently mobilized following the angel's report. These crews reached the Golan in the afternoon and stopped the Syrian advance in the Nafa sector." At the war's end, under unprecedented public pressure, Israel's government appointed a board of inquiry, headed by Supreme Court Judge Shimon Agranat, to investigate the decision-making process during the Yom Kippur War.
The board ordered the immediate discharge of General Eli Ze'ira and several other officers, including Chief of Staff David Elazar.
But who was the angel? An unending flow of stories, reports, and books, all of them erroneous, about his identity have been published throughout the years. It was obvious that the angel was somebody very close to Egypt's governing circles and Egyptian army's supreme command, but no one ever pierced the armor of secrecy that protected his real identity. Journalists and analysts called him by several code names and painted a figure blessed with legendary talents. He became the hero of many spy stories and even some best-selling novels.
After his discharge, General Ze'ira carried his frustration deep in his heart.
He was determined to prove his innocence and reveal his version of the 1973 events to the world. He finally decided to write a book and give his own answer to the question, why did he reject the angel's report? The general wrote that the angel was nothing less than a double agent who had been planted in the Mossad by the wily Egyptians in order to mislead the Israelis.
Some reporters bought Ze'ira's story and wrote that the angel was indeed a double agent par excellence.
The angel's role, they explained, was, over a length of time, to deliver to Israel truthful and accurate intelligence in order to win its trust. And then, when the Mossad was practically eating out of his hand, feed it a monstrous lie that would destroy it. It was a great story. It explained everything. Almost.
Because both Ze'ira and his followers chose to disregard one single fact.
All the angel's reports, from the very beginning until the very end, had been absolutely accurate. So where was the lie? And when the angel could mislead Israel and inform it that the massing of troops on the Suez Canal's shore was just a maneuver and there was no danger of war, the double agent chose the opposite solution. He called Zamir's aide in England and sent him the warning, chemicals, then flew to London and warned Zamir that the surprise attack was imminent.
But Ze'ira could not be stopped. In 2004, when a new edition of his book was published, he went a step further and revealed the angel's identity to the public. In a series of interviews, culminating with a television news show hosted by veteran journalist Dan Margalit, Ze'ira used the angel's real name.
Ashraf Marwan. The name stunned all those familiar with the Egyptian political circles. They could not believe that Marwan might be an Israeli spy. But who was this master spy? Who was Ashraf Marwan? In 1965, a sweet, shy Egyptian girl met a charming and handsome young man at the Heliopolis tennis court. The girl, Muna, was the third daughter in her family, and not exactly the smartest. Her sister Huda was more gifted and an A student at the Giza High School. But Muna was cute, charming, and her father's favorite child. The young man she had met came from a respectable and well-off family. He had just graduated with a BS in chemistry and had joined the army. And Muna fell for him head over heels. Shortly afterward, she introduced her boyfriend to her family. That's how the young man met Muna's father, Egypt's president, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Nasser was not sure that his daughter had met the ideal match, but she did not leave him any choice. Finally, Nasser invited the young man's father, a senior officer in the president's guard, to his office, and the two men agreed that their children should get married. A year later, in July 1966, the young people were wed. Soon after, Muna's young husband was posted at the chemical department of the Republic Guards, and at the end of 1968, was transferred to the Presidential Department of Science. The name of the president's son-in-law was Ashraf Marwan. The young man apparently was not satisfied with his new job. He asked Nasser for permission to pursue his studies in London. Nasser agreed, and Ashraf Marwan, alone, settled in England's capital, under the close supervision of the Egyptian embassy. But the supervision, apparently, was not close enough. Ashraf Marwan loved the good life, the parties, the adventures, and London of the 60s generously supplied all of that. It didn't take long for the young Egyptian to spend all his allowance. He needed another source of financing for his nightly pleasures, and soon he found it. Her name was Su'ad, and she was married to the Kuwaiti Sheikh Abdullah Mubarak al-Sabah. Ashraf charmed the romantic lady, and she opened her purse in return. But the arrangement did not last long. The affair was exposed, and an angry Nasser had the bad boy sent home in disgrace. Nasser demanded that Muna divorce the adulterer, but she flatly refused. Nasser finally decided that Marwan would remain in Egypt and be allowed to go to London only to deliver his papers to his professors. Marwan also had to pay back all the money he had received from Su'ad al-Sabah. He got a job in Nasser's office, and once in a while he would be charged with petty tasks or missions. In 1969, Ashraf Marwan came to London again to submit an essay to the university, but on that occasion he also took the first step to betraying his father-in-law. His humiliation by Egypt's president had left him bitter and frustrated. He did not hesitate. He phoned the Israeli embassy and asked to speak to the military attaché. When an officer answered, Marwan identified himself by his real name and bluntly said that he wanted to work for Israel. He asked that his offer be forwarded to the people dealing with this kind of activity. The officer who received his call did not take him seriously and did not report the call. Marwan's second call also remained unanswered. But the story reached some Mossad officials. The chief of the Mossad European section, Shmuel Goren, received a phone call from Marwan. Goren knew who Marwan was aware of the man's important position, and asked Marwan not to call the embassy anymore. He gave him an unlisted number and immediately alerted some of his colleagues. Goren's top-secret report was handed to Tzvi Zamir and to Rehavia Vardi, the head of Tzomet, the Mossad Department for Agent Recruitment. The two of them appointed a special team to check Marwan's offer in depth. On the one hand, Marwan's move had all the characteristics of a classic sting operation. Somebody high up in an enemy organization volunteers as an agent, and no effort is needed to recruit him. That seems very suspicious. The man can be a double agent, sent over as bait by the Egyptian services. But on the other hand, the same equation might have the opposite meaning. Somebody high up in the enemy organization volunteers as an agent. He certainly must have access to ultra-secret material that nobody else can provide. Perhaps, after all, he was the ideal agent, the one every secret service in the world dreamed about. Besides, Vardy's men knew who Marwan was, an ambitious young man, a hedonist, therefore somebody who loved money. The temptation for Mossad recruiters was great. Goren returned to London and asked to meet Marwan. Marwan agreed and arrived elegantly dressed, ever the handsome young man. He openly told Gorin that he had been deeply disappointed by Egypt's defeat in the 1967 Six-Day War and had decided to join the winner. But beside that ideological motive, Marwan asked for lots of money, $100,000 for every meeting in which he would deliver a report to his handlers. Gorin was inclined to accept the offer in spite of the huge cost. Such sums had never before been paid to a Mossad agent. But first, Gorin needed tangible proof that Marwan was as good as his word. He asked him for a sample of the secret documents he could deliver. The delivery of the documents would also tie Marwan to the Mossad. It was self-incriminating, solid proof that Marwan had become an Israeli agent. From the Egyptian point of view, that would make him a traitor and an enemy agent. Marwan did not let Gorin wait long and brought the full minutes of the talks held by President Nasser with the leaders of the Soviet Union in Moscow on January 22, 1970. In that visit, Nasser demanded that the Soviets supply him with modern, long-range jet bombers that could carry out bombings deep inside Israel. The document astonished all those who read it. They had never seen such a paper. Its authenticity was beyond doubt. Now the Mossad chiefs realized that they had a fabulous treasure in their hands. They appointed Duby as Marwan's handler and sent him to London. They also took immediate care of all the arrangements, renting an apartment in London for the meetings with the angel, equipping it with hidden listening and recording devices, securing it, establishing a special fund for the financing of their star agent. The games could start. The meetings were initiated by Marwan himself, whenever he had something to report. According to the rules established with Duby, Marwan would make a phone call to a middleman. Some sources claim that he used to call Jewish women in London, and the Mossad would be alerted. Marwan provided his handlers with lots of intelligence and top-secret political and military documents. Colonel Meir Meir, the head of Branch 6, Egyptian Army in Amman, participated in several of those meetings. Meir used to fly to London under an assumed identity. All identifying labels would have been removed from his clothes. He used to move around London for hours, by foot, in cabs and buses, to make absolutely sure he was not followed, then finally reach the apartment building and go up to the 6th floor. When he came to the apartment the first time, he met there a handsome but unpleasant man who openly disdained him and condescendingly glowered at him. Marwan softened up only when he realized that Meir was a man of vast knowledge and experience. Once, Meir was asked by his Mossad friend to bring a briefcase to Marwan. When he asked what was in the case, his friend winked at him and said, "A penthouse in Hamedina Square, the most exclusive neighborhood in Tel Aviv," hinting that it carried a fabulous sum of money. According to Mossad estimates, Marwan's reports during his secret service for Israel cost the Jewish state more than $3 million. Nasser died on September 28, 1970, and was replaced by Anwar Sadat. Professor Shimon Shamir, one of the foremost Egypt scholars in Israel, analyzed Sadat's character for the Mossad. "A feeble, dull man," Shamir said. He stressed that Sadat would not stay long in power or go to war. Many of Egypt's leaders thought the same, but Marwan decided to back Sadat unconditionally. He took the keys to Nasser's personal safe from his wife, collected the most important files and documents, and brought them to the new president. He stood by him again in May 1971, when some of Egypt's leaders conspired to carry out a pro-Soviet coup. Some of the most famous names in Egypt were among the conspirers: Ali Sabri, a former vice president; Mahmoud Fawzi, a former minister of war; Sharawi Guma, minister of the interior; and other ministers and members of parliament. The plan was to assassinate Sadat during his visit to Alexandria University. but Sadat moved first and arrested all the conspirators. Marwan stood by him and assisted Sadat when he smashed the conspiracy. The results were not long coming. Marwan's position in the Egyptian hierarchy vastly improved. He was appointed presidential secretary for information and special advisor to the president. He accompanied Sadat on his trips throughout the Arab world and took part in top-level political talks. As Marwan's status improved, so did his reports. In 1971, Sadat traveled to Moscow several times and presented Leonid Brezhnev with a shopping list of the weapons he needed to attack Israel. The list included, among other things, MiG-25 aircraft. Marwan delivered the list to his Mossad handlers. When they asked for the minutes of the Sadat-Brezhnev talks, Marwan brought that too. Tzvi Zamir was profoundly impressed by Marwan's reports and met him in person. The material provided by Marwan was distributed to a few senior Mossad and Amman officers, the IDF chief of staff and his deputy, Prime Minister Golda Meir, Minister of Defense Moshe Dayan, and Golda's confidant, Minister without Portfolio, Israel Galili.